Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present political analyst, historian, and author Thomas Frank, who examines the reasons why so many Democrats failed to turn out to support Hillary Clinton, delivering the presidency to Donald Trump. Dr. Willie Parker, board chair of the group Physicians for Reproductive Health, who looks at the consequences for women's health of further restrictions on reproductive rights under President Trump. And Vermont State Representative Chris Pearson, who talks about the campaign organized by the group National Popular Vote to nullify the Electoral College and guarantee the presidency to the candidate who receives the most votes nationwide. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid the right-wing backlash that elected Donald Trump president, voters in California, Nevada, Massachusetts, and Maine approved ballot measures authorizing the recreational use of marijuana. These states now join Colorado, Alaska, Oregon, and Washington State in legalizing the sale of marijuana for personal use. Voters coast to coast dramatically increased the legal market for the sale of marijuana and put new pressure on the federal government to decriminalize the drug. However, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration still classifies pot as a Schedule I substance with no legitimate medical use. Due to its continued illegal federal status, cannabis producers have difficulty operating across state lines and cannot use bank accounts or credit cards. Yet, with the latest election victories, the legal sale of marijuana is expected to grow into a $20 billion market and generate an estimated $1 billion in tax revenue in California. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump took a hands-off approach on marijuana policy, saying it was up to states to regulate the sale of the drug. But the growing reform movement could be derailed by two possible Trump nominees as attorney general, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who both took a hard line against the legalization of marijuana. Montreal police used 24 surveillance warrants to track the cell phone calls and text messages of popular columnist Patrick Lagacé of the French-language newspaper La Presse, who is often critical of the Montreal Police Department. The police say the warrants, approved by a judge, were legal and part of a larger internal investigation inside the department's embattled anti-gang unit. The investigation targeted police officer Faisal Jalidzi, who was in contact with reporters. The disclosure of warrants on Lagacé led to other revelations of covert surveillance of journalists by security officials. Canadian intelligence agencies have also used metadata surveillance programs to monitor average citizens. In September, police seized a computer used by a Journal de Montréal reporter because they said it allegedly held illegally obtained evidence. Early in the spring, a rogue unit inside the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were found to be spying on two journalists without authorization during an inquiry on leaks. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, speaking to a group at McGill University via a video link from Moscow, called the use of warrants on working journalists a radical attack on the operations of a free press. Snowden called for Montreal Police Chief Philippe Pichet to resign. Water politics is deeply rooted in central Washington state, as rivers fed by melting snow feed an agricultural region that has blossomed into the apple basket of the world. But climate change has reduced snowmelt in the Pacific Northwest, ramping up competition for scarce water resources. State and federal courts have ruled farmers must leave enough river water for endangered fish to survive in dry summer months. With rising temperatures, limited access to water has diminished the quality of the region's green apple crop. But farmers are now collaborating with environmentalists, Native Americans, and state officials to conserve water resources and restore the natural landscape in the Yakima Basin. The regional plan calls for voluntary conservation measures, along with the construction of new water storage facilities. The compact, approved in 2012, shows promise of becoming a national model. Yet with or without cooperation, climate change is making water managers' jobs far more complex in the vast Columbia River system. They are often hamstrung. court decisions requiring wildlife protection and rigid federal timelines for releasing water have left them with little flexibility to adjust to the changing precipitation patterns a changing climate has produced. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
For weeks, pollsters across the board had predicted a decisive victory for Hillary Clinton in the November 8th presidential election. As the returns came in, it was apparent that the Democratic Party coalition that had delivered two previous victories for President Barack Obama failed to materialize for the former senator and secretary of state. Overall, voter turnout was down, with some 43% of eligible voters deciding not to participate, a 20-year low. While Hillary Clinton won the national popular vote, Trump won the Electoral College vote due to the geographic location of his supporters, many in the important Rust Belt states of Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Trump received roughly 5 million fewer votes than Mitt Romney did in 2012, but Hillary Clinton lost because she got roughly 10 million fewer votes than Obama in 2012 and 15 million fewer votes than Obama received in 2008. In examining the reasons why Democrats failed to come out to support their nominee, political analyst, historian, and author Thomas Frank argues that Hillary Clinton was exactly the wrong candidate for this angry populist moment, a technocrat who offered fine-tuning when the country wanted to take a sledgehammer to the machine. This against a backdrop of Democrats in general failing to lift up American workers, many still struggling to recover from the 2008 economic meltdown. Your reporter spoke with Frank, who examines the reasons why so many voters failed to turn out to support Clinton, and what the Democrats must do to restructure their party's priorities to address Americans' economic insecurity.
You know, Hillary was uniquely vulnerable to the campaign of Trump. In fact, my opinion is that Trump basically chose his issues because he knew that Hillary would be the Democratic candidate. Everybody could see that, long before. But the trade issue in particular, Hillary was uniquely vulnerable on that front because of her husband's deeds as president. And it's also the sort of the philosophy of Clintonism, which treats big parts of the Democratic, constituency with the phrase, they have nowhere else to go. So the Democrat, the leaders don't have to deliver anything to the rank and file because they know that they won't vote for the Republicans, and so therefore they can, treat them badly and reach out to affluent people that they, or they do what they really want to do, which is to be a party of the wealthy. I mean, we really have now learned the folly of these strategies.
I certainly wanted to explore the issues of the Democratic Party not delivering to working class people in this country any kind of program to address growing income inequality that's been apparent for quite some time, long before the Occupy Wall Street movement. This is a reality that certainly affects more than just Democrats. And obviously, Donald Trump struck a chord with the people who are coping with that same reality.
Well, when you put it in those terms, you see what you're getting at here. You're describing the same thing that put Barack Obama in the White House in 2008. Only then it was a hopeful movement. I mean, people were scared then too. People were frightened. But what you see in the Trump phenomenon is desperation. It is hope after it has curdled in vinegar for 8 years. People had such high expectations for Barack Obama. And they were disappointed, and I think that they were right to be disappointed. He really did not deliver in all sorts of ways that people expected him to, and things that he could easily have done. It's not like they were expecting things that were outlandish or, really radical or completely off the table. He just didn't deliver them. When I say desperation, we're talking about people that can see their way of life slipping away from them. That the middle class of this country is crumbling. This is terrifying to people. And they rolled the dice and took a chance on Trump. Hillary did not really promise anything different. I mean, if you read the campaign platform very closely, she had a lot of things that I thought were pretty awesome. I voted for her. I'm certainly not going to vote for a guy like Trump. But the thing is that nobody believed her promises. Nobody really thought she would actually try to get them done. There's just something about the way the Democrats have ruled. It's not just something vague. People knew that they couldn't really expect anything different from Hillary.
Thomas Frank, do you have optimism that the Democratic Party or progressive forces in general around the country, given the success, the relative success of Bernie Sanders and the enthusiastic support he gathered during the Democratic primary contest, that there is a force in the country that can address some of these deep-seated economic concerns and fears of a lot of people, but move it in a progressive direction, a direction that doesn't prey on people's fears and prejudices?
Well, of course, I have hope that will come to pass. That's got to be the next step within the Democratic Party. That's got to be the next measure that they take. It's the end of the road for Clintonism, I think. Look, in some ways, I'm very hopeful about the situation that we're in. Trump has shown, among other things, that anything is possible in politics. Hillary outspent him. I mean, she had ads everywhere. He had virtually none. She had every newspaper endorsement in America. She had celebrities behind her. She had everything going for her. And this guy won. All the rules that we have been told were, set in stone for my entire lifetime, all those rules are gone. All the stuff about how you have to have billionaires on your side and, you have to be able to match the Republicans in ads, none of that means anything anymore. And there is a really wonderful freedom out there, and I hope that we can take advantage of it and rebuild this thing.
That was political analyst, historian, and author Thomas Frank, whose books include What's the Matter with Kansas? His most recent book is titled Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Find links to Thomas Frank's articles and other election analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Access to reproductive health care is but one of a myriad of issues that are likely to be the target of aggressive attack under the presidency of Donald J. Trump. Directly after the election, Dr. Willie Parker, board chair of the group Physicians for Reproductive Health, issued a statement saying his colleagues were deeply disheartened by the election of Donald Trump. A Trump presidency, he said, will mean that attacks on access to abortion and all other reproductive health services will continue at the federal level and in states all across the country. The statement went on to say, "As physicians, we know firsthand the medical and social harms inflicted on our patients by politically motivated policies that prevent access to safe and comprehensive reproductive health care, including abortion." A few days later, Trump said in a television interview on 60 Minutes that if the right to abortion is overturned by a Supreme Court to which he has promised to appoint anti-abortion justices, the issue would revert back to the states, which have a checkerboard of laws regulating the procedure. Dr. Parker responded by saying, "Roe versus Wade has been the law of the land for 43 years and is supported by the majority of Americans. We have seen how unconstitutional laws that force women to travel to other states for abortion care make this care essentially unobtainable. Of great concern to physicians and epidemiologists is a rise in maternal mortality in the U.S. compared with other wealthy nations that many researchers link to the imposition of restrictions on reproductive health care." Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Parker, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, about his concerns, especially for low-income women and women of color, who will be most at risk from future changes in law that could result in the denial of the right to an abortion.
Thankfully, maternal mortality is a rare enough event. Even when you don't see them frequently, a few maternal deaths can raise the rate greatly. What I do see, I'm glad that it's actually finally showing up, because one of the places where that rate has gone up significantly, or a couple of places, have been Texas and Mississippi, two places that have restricted access to abortion. maternal mortality comes from pregnancy, forcing women to continue pregnancies that they don't want or that they're too sick to continue, it only made sense to me that the maternal mortality ratio would go up. And so I'm not happy that that ratio is going up. What I'm relieved about is that finally the implications of restricting women's access to safe and legal abortion and thereby forcing them to continue pregnancies, it only stands to reason that there are going to be consequences to that, one of which is women who are forced to stay pregnant remain at risk for maternal death. And we're seeing some of those maternal deaths.
Well, Dr. Willie Parker, there are other causes of maternal mortality besides being denied access to abortion, right? Women who want to carry their pregnancies to term but are denied basic prenatal care could also suffer serious consequences. I'm thinking of all the Planned Parenthood clinics in Texas that were forced to close, clinics that low-income women depended on for all their care.
Well, to your point, I did research on maternal mortality when I was with the CDC, and what we know about maternal mortality is that it's multifactorial. When we look at the causes or the parameters with regard to the content of prenatal care, access to prenatal care, the health issues that women have going into pregnancy that might put them at risk, we know that many factors that contribute to maternal mortality are deemed to be potentially alterable. So those factors that are alterable, when we detect them with triage in prenatal care. So, for example, one of the major causes is hypertension-related preeclampsia or pregnancy-related hypertension. Those are things that can be detected with regular prenatal care. And when you see somebody who has worsening hypertension in pregnancy, you can then make the decision to deliver them earlier, watching them more closely. Again, if someone is not getting prenatal care, that kind of condition can worsen undetected. And you're only to find out that this woman, when she died from a heart attack or a stroke related to elevated blood pressure in pregnancy, that could have been prevented if she had gotten prenatal care and that had been detected and intervened on.
Donald Trump has been all over the map on abortion, and I personally don't believe for a minute that he's anti-choice.
I hope you're right. I hope that he was trying to consolidate a political base that would get them to vote for him, and that I hope there is a bait and switch. I hope that they will be sorely wrong. But what I really believe is that we don't know what he'll do. And we don't know if he will actually follow through on compromising access to abortion care. But we do know the vice president-elect is explicitly anti-abortion and has pledged to seek an amendment to make abortion illegal. I do believe that there's a possibility that he will go after low-hanging fruit like repealing Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And part of his interest in it will be the symbolic value of repealing an accomplishment named for President Obama, which is part of the sentiment that drove his campaign was anti-Obama. There's the implication of the repeal of Obamacare. It will be the loss of women who were able to access contraception because it's considered preventive services, and they could access contraception, make contraceptive choices with no copay. The loss of the access to moderate methods of contraception means that there will be more women who will go unprotected and be at risk for unplanned pregnancy. So that's making a little bit more explicit what it would mean if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. I do believe that he may be inclined to stack the Supreme Court with anti-abortion justices that will paint the way for an effort to repeal the Roe decision. I don't want to be a doomsday prophet. I could just say that everything's going to be affected by this presidency.
That was Dr. Willie Parker, board chair of the group Physicians for Reproductive Health. Learn more about the group's work and Trump's position on abortion by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the aftermath of the 2016 U.S. election, millions of Americans were in a state of shock, given that most public opinion polls had predicted a solid win for former First Lady, New York Senator, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Although Clinton won more votes nationwide, New York real estate billionaire Donald Trump won the presidency through his victory in the archaic system known as the Electoral College. Trump's racist, xenophobic, and misogynist campaign rhetoric fed widespread anger and fear of the election outcome. Almost immediately, protesters filled the streets of cities and towns across the nation, where tens of thousands of people carried signs and shouted the slogan, "Trump is not my president." Among the actions taken by anti-Trump activists was signing onto a petition demanding that the electors of the Electoral College cast their ballots for Hillary Clinton, asserting that Trump is unfit to serve and Clinton had won the popular vote. More than 4 million signatures have been collected on the petition as of November 15th. Many historians and political observers say the effort to convince electors to defy the conventional practice of casting Electoral College ballots corresponding to the winning candidate of each state has little chance of success. However, another parallel campaign to nullify the Electoral College in favor of honoring the popular vote in future elections appears to be viable. The bipartisan group, National Popular Vote, is pursuing a strategy to pass legislation in states that would pledge their electors to the candidate who wins the most votes nationwide. The system would be activated once that legislation is adopted by enough states, constituting the necessary majority 270 electoral votes a candidate must attain. Your reporter spoke with Vermont State Representative Chris Pearson, a board member of National Popular Vote, who explains the campaign's goals and why he supports the effort.
National Popular Vote is a state-based effort to, sometimes we say, fix the Electoral College. And the Electoral College is part of the Constitution. So states, some people think, well, what role do states have? And in fact, states have a very important role. That's because Connecticut has electors, but the state legislature in Connecticut, as an example, and in every state, dictates how those electors behave. Now, you've passed the winner-take-all rule in Connecticut, and that's the law, the state law that directs electors in virtually every state, but not all of them. And so the winner-take-all rule just simply says when Hillary Clinton gets more popular votes in Connecticut than Donald Trump, she gets all of your electors. And that's the law in just about the whole country. And that is actually the root of our challenge, where we have winners who don't necessarily get the most votes in the country. And I would argue, as important as that challenge to the way we think of elections is the fact that even if you look over the last 3 months, two-thirds of the whole campaign, a very rigorous and some might say tiring election for our country, two-thirds of the whole election took place in six states, and over 90% of the election took place in just 12 states. That's really damaging to our democratic process. So we have a lot of challenges with the way the Electoral College works today. National Popular Vote is taking advantage of the state power to award their own electors, and when our bill passes enough states, we'll still have the Electoral College, but it will just simply ratify the candidate that gets the most popular votes in the whole country. And once we pass our bill in enough states, you'll have a one person, one vote. You'll have every voter in every state mattering in every presidential election. And you will guarantee that the candidate that gets the most popular votes in the country goes to the White House. All three of those are basic principles in the way we run elections. That's how I won office. I got more votes than my opponent, and that's how we think of the democratic process. But, of course, that's not always the case in the presidential election.
Chris, review for our audience the states that have thus far passed the National Popular Vote legislation.
Well, Maryland was first, quickly joined by New Jersey. In New England, we have Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont on board, New York State's there, Illinois, Washington, California, Hawaii, as a matter of fact, and then the District of Columbia. So those are the 11, it's not quite fair to say 11 states, 11 jurisdictions when you include the District of Columbia. Those states total have 165 electors. The whole agreement, our bill, does not take effect until more states come on board. so that together these states hold a majority of the electors. So 270 electors is the trigger that we need to reach. So if you think of it this way, so far those 11 states, they're pooling their electors together. It's not a big enough pool yet to elect a president. A week ago, Vermont, even though we've passed this bill, we're using the winner-take-all rule until the national popular vote takes effect. When more states come on board so that the states who've passed the bill hold 270 electors or more, that's a majority, then the whole thing goes into effect. And it doesn't matter which states pass the bill. You simply run a campaign, you add up the popular votes in all 50 states, and the candidate that gets the most popular votes in the country is going to be guaranteed this block of at least 270 electors, and therefore they go to the White House.
How can citizens become involved in the National Popular Vote campaign, either in their own states or to support your effort nationally, state by state? Because certainly with the results of the 2016 election combined with the 2000 election, where the presidential candidate with less votes than their opponent nevertheless won the White House, sticks in people's craw as a real injustice, provides a real urgent sense that we have to fix our democratic system, which certainly with the Electoral College in place in these two elections is not democratic at all.
Yeah, no, we need people's help. So the best way to do it is to visit nationalpopularvote.com. And the most simple way to help is to click on the Write Your Legislator button. Just put in your address and off goes a letter that you can edit and make sure feels good to you. We are increasingly building a grassroots campaign to help legislators push this across the finish line. And I want to just say it again so that listeners know, we are 60% of the way there. We've passed this in 11 states. We need to pass it in a handful of more states. And we should be able to do this in time for the 2020 election. Let's make 2016 the last election where we run a campaign effectively in six states and where we don't treat every vote equal and we leave so many states out there being totally taken for granted.
That was Vermont State Representative Chris Pearson, a board member of the group National Popular Vote. Learn more about the campaign to nullify the anti-democratic effect of the Electoral College by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.